Hello, and welcome to a special edition of the Bike Portland podcast about bikes and low-car life in PDX, taped live at Simple Headquarters in the Pearl on a rainy Thursday. I'm Lillian Kerbake.
I'm Michael Anderson. Each month, the Bike Portland podcast goes in-depth on a subject that matters to Portlanders who get around without a car.
Well, nearly every month. We've been on hiatus for the past 6 months, but we've returned for a special live show to talk about one of my favorite things.
Robots!
Kind of robots.
We're here with some very special guests to answer your most burning questions and ours about the intersection of technology and transportation.
The intersection. I see what you did there.
It was too good to resist.
Tech and transportation is a huge subject. We'll be talking about self-driving cars
and bikes,
how to get a good bike count data to cities cheaply, and
I'm going to introduce our special guests. First, we have Noelle Mickleberry. She's the executive director of Oregon Walks, the state's pedestrian advocacy organization. Her most recent important achievement is being named an everyday hero by a sixth grader at Beaverton Health and Sciences Middle School. I know. Congratulations. We have William Henderson, founder of Knock Software and the maker of the new Ride Report app, which automatically gives you credit for every ride you take, lets you rate your trips, and gives the data to cities to make the roads better for everyone. Hi, William. We've got Michael Teta, the CEO of the Community Cycling Center, which is a nonprofit that for 21 years has worked to broaden access to cycling in the Portland area and beyond. Hi, Michael. And last but not least, we've got Chris Smith, the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commissioner, creator of the Transit Appliance, tells you when your bus is arriving, editor of portlandtransport.org, and all around really smart guy who knows more about bike parking standards than most people know about their jobs. Hi, Chris. So, here's how it's going to work. Like we do in our other year-end shows here at the Bike Portland podcast, we are going to put 40 minutes on the clock, and we are going to attempt to answer as many questions as possible in that 40 minutes. We've got a list of 20. We're probably not going to get through all of them, but we're going to try. So everybody's going to be able to limit their answers to key concepts. We're also going to do this quiz bowl format. So that means that when you have an answer, that you when you want to answer one of these questions, you need to say bzzz and raise the little traffic signal. Noelle, do you want to do that for us? That's good. Okay, so Noelle will do that, and then that will mean that she has claimed, thanks so much, Jonathan, she has claimed the traffic signal priority, and she's going to answer that question. So everybody be ready with your fingers and your brains. And we're going to put 40 minutes on the clock, and then we're going to give some time for folks in the audience to ask questions as well once we've got through that. You guys ready?
Yeah.
All right, and we're going to share microphones a little bit. Here we go. It's ticking. First question. nice try, Teta. Last week, the federal DOT announced a smart city challenge that's open to Portland and 101 other mid-sized cities. The winner gets $50 million to use technology to improve their transport systems. $50 million. Application deadline is February 4th at 3 p.m. You're the mayor. What's Portland's application?
Well, real quickly, and hopefully other people get a chance to answer here too, I want $1 million worth of staff, $20 million worth of bicycle-based bicycle proliferation initiatives, $10 million worth of initial data collection hardware and analysis, $10 million worth of fleet maintenance jobs, and I need $9 million worth of bikes for kids, which would cover all 68,500 children in the K-12 in the Portland Public Schools.
You get a bike, and you get a bike, and you get a bike. All right. Go ahead.
Man, I wish I had $50 million. That would be great to spend on traffic and transportation. What I would do, and I had like 3 minutes to think about this, but I think I would probably try to start an initiative where people could opt into putting little, basically, speed governors into their car in exchange for an insurance discount. And it would basically keep track of their speeding and tell them via an app or something on their dashboard that they've gone above their allocated allowed speeding per month, and they're going to pay for it if they don't slow down, and try to do something innovative there, because I think, you know, speeding and now distracted driving are totally solvable problems, and they're one of the few problems that technology can solve. So we should go after it.
The dream of the 20s.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's great. Any other answers before we move on? All right, time's up. Next question. Which company has done more to improve low-car life? Apple, Google, or Amazon? Chris, need to buzz.
I'm sorry.
That's better.
Your beer.
I don't have enough hands for the mic and my beer.
Priorities.
Well, I'm going to vote for Amazon, because that's in my personal lifestyle. That's allowed me to make a lot of my purchases without ever leaving my home. Now, the question is that a net VMT positive or negative? And I think the jury is still out on that, but it's been transformational for me. What's VMT? Vehicle miles traveled. So the question is, does the amount of gasoline saved by me not driving a car to the store save more than what the UPS truck coming to my house is burning? And
how can that every UPS trip is chained, right? So how can that possibly be less efficient?
I think that's my gut instinct, but I think the research is still being done.
I don't disagree, but I feel like Google sort of deserves the reward, because they've done the most proactively to work with transit agencies, starting with TriMet, to make transit data available and build decent directions and navigation systems for transit. Apple, I think, deserves specially to be called out for sucking. Apple didn't even know Tillicum was a thing until like 3 weeks ago. Like, you would just pull up the map and there was nothing there except a Starbucks. So we can at least agree on that, right?
William bites the hand that feeds him right there. Noelle.
Is it on now? Yeah, okay. I feel silly because I was going to say Apple. just because I use my smartphone to figure things out in a way that I wouldn't have done before, whether it's, you know, finding the nearest transit stop, or if it's finding restaurants that are close by that I don't have to drive to, things like that. I think it gives you a lot of options. So that was my answer.
Yeah, I'm with that personally. The smartphone. Enough said. I don't know. All right. Third question. What is a transportation problem that you have seen social media activism actually make a difference in? This is like the hippie question in our tech list. Social media activism, have you seen it actually work in transportation problem solving? Or if you haven't, what's a scenario in which it could? Noelle.
There's a certain issue that I'm hoping to see social media activism make a difference in, and it's something that we've been focusing on around construction detours, and how it's a major issue that that sidewalks and often bike lanes aren't prioritized when new construction goes up. And there's a real lack of understanding on the kind of the vastness of the problem, where it's happening, who's being impacted by it, and seeing it all in one place, I think, is a place where people online can share photos, and we could possibly be in a spot soon where we could map all of those in a way that can directly inform the city on where these are happening. Because there are often, you know, parallel construction projects that the city doesn't even necessarily know are right next to each other that are closing both the sides of the sidewalk, and we want to be able to highlight that. I think social media is a place where we can start.
Any others? Go ahead.
I think we'd be amiss to not specifically say Bike Portland. I mean, it's amazing to think about what Portland would be like if Bike Portland didn't exist. And I think, you know, it's not to say that it's completely a technology or social media product, but without those tools, it might not have been a thing.
That was not seated. Thank you so much. Great. All right. Among other things, Ride Report, this was seated, helps cities get better bike count data, but do cities actually do anything with bike count data? Does it actually help change infrastructure or policy? Who cares? Chris.
It's all right.
So I haven't seen a lot yet, but I think the potential is there in planning. And, you know, I'm a planning commissioner, and a lot of our planning is very data-driven. And the opportunity I see is that, you know, we rely on transportation modeling to sort of figure out what's going to happen over the next 20 years. And when we introduce new technologies, the interesting thing is when the real-world results don't match the model. So, for example, we saw that for streetcar. I mean, the models, we run the models, and they say you're going to get 3,000 passengers, and we get 6,000. So I think the opportunity is to use the bike count data to calibrate our models, and I think it'll tell us a lot about the value of comfortable facilities, because the model may say that X number of people want to get from A to B, and they're not. That's probably an indication of the quality of the facilities, and if the bike count data can tell us what facilities people are responding to, that's a very strong indicator.
So for me, I think one of the most exciting things about having this data is breaking the sort of data monopoly that traffic engineers have had for the past forever. And it's not to say we don't have awesome traffic engineers that have forward-thinking, especially in Portland. I mean, it's kind of a given. But there's a lot of cities where that's not true. And even here, we're working with agencies, I won't name names, but certain state agencies that maybe don't share the same mentality. And they have a data monopoly. And as advocates and as planners, even at the city level, we can't, you know, we're not on a level playing field in terms of being equipped with data. Because data is not... A lot of people think or like to believe, especially engineers, that data can say something. It can't, right? There's a bias in every single data source that you have out there. And you can ask a question, you're going to get a certain answer that's colored by how you ask it. So it's totally unfair, you know, to have one source of data that one group can have. And with data that's being generated, hopefully, from smartphones in a really inexpensive way, and that's being published in an open way so that it has access not just to planners and engineers but to advocates as well, we can hopefully break the monopoly down.
I should say you guys can feel free to jump in and ask each other questions and so on. It would be great if you have thoughts and reactions. I've got a question. But so we have the data, like we have the argument. Does it do any good? Doesn't people still show up at the city council meeting and complain about losing a parking space? What's the difference? Are we just hoping that around the corners the staff will be well-informed and will make decisions in the public interest?
Well, we can hold them accountable if we have data, right? Like, we have data that suggests that ODOT knew about the gap in their bike lane facility where someone died. And there's no denying that, right? And I mean, that's maybe a little bit of a loaded example, but I think the point is that when you have the data, there's nowhere to hide. It's still going to require a lot of legwork on the advocacy side. It's not like the data itself will magically make things better, but it's a tool.
I've got a similar question. This one is about walking. Walking trips are actually about as common as car trips, but despite bazillions of dollars in technology that helps us plan car transportation, cities currently use almost no technology that help us plan for better walking. How could that change? So it's a tie. Okay, the professional is going to answer this one.
I don't know about that.
First.
But so there's something that this is something that we've been looking at, and we have volunteers looking at and been working on a model for the walkway network. Because currently, you know, we look at streets as, you know, cross sections where two streets intersect, but that doesn't take into account sidewalk system or crosswalk systems that inhibit or enable people to get to their destinations. So this is something that we're trying to see implemented so that we can actually track how people can get to and from where they need to go. Like today, my partner's Google app told him to walk along 13th to get here, and there's no sidewalk, and a lot of the places you actually have to walk upstairs to get to the to the protected area, and that's not a viable option for people using mobility devices or simply just walking and wanting to feel safe.
So our current, everything just currently assumes that every road is just a line, basically, when, of course, there are multiple
exactly.
lines overlapping each other.
Yeah, and there and that's, yeah, having different models, too, for what kind of infrastructure improvements, how that can change how someone can access a store or something, you know, taking into account crosswalks versus full stops versus rapid flashing beacons and what those different inhibitors have an impact on how people can get to where they need to go.
So what's the role of your volunteers? They're working on the software that the city is going to use for this, or are they documenting the data that the city is going to put into the software?
Kind of both, but we have volunteers that are actually working in Tigard right now on modeling the walkway network there and also working on the Powell Division BRT to look at kind of walk sheds around bus stations. So what is the real quarter mile radius to a bus station if you look at the walkway network versus the street network?
Chris?
So I'm going to flip William's application on its head. William is using the smartphone as a sensor. All our smartphones are also beacons, right? They're all putting out a Bluetooth signal or a cellular signal. And there are technologies now that will let you basically count those. So, you know, we could have essentially wireless pedestrian counters sitting on corners developing data for us about, you know, which pedestrian paths are being used the most. So I think there's an opportunity to get good data that, you know, in the era of rubber tubes to count tires, you couldn't possibly gather, that we now have the technology to gather.
That's a perfect segue. Do you have
more? We're actually doing that in airports right now so that they can essentially see, you know, how long you have to wait and how long you have to walk and stuff like that to get around.
Awesome. Perfect segue. Some people have used the term digital redlining to refer to big data tools that neglect marginalized groups, like deciding where to build bike lanes based on where Strava or smartphone users happen to ride, where smartphone users happen to walk, that example. Do you agree that this is a risk in transportation technology? And if so, how do we spot it when that happens? How do we identify digital redlining when we see it? William.
Yes, absolutely. I think the first thing you have to do is acknowledge that there's a problem. And not only that there's a problem, but then in the past, I think a lot of technologies have overpromised how egalitarian a solution they can provide. I know the Strava data, for example, claims they've got 40% commutes, 40% of their rides are commutes, but then they say their average commute length is 25 miles. And so you just have to be, I think, a little bit humble and honest with what your solution can provide and what it can't. At the same time, I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of our existing methods have biases built in as well. So counts are great because they include everyone, but right now we only count commuters. And if you look at the data in terms of survey data, it's one of the least accessible forms of riding a bike. It's really hard to become a commuter, and most people are more interested in errands and trips within their neighborhood. And then when we go and do planning, a lot of times we're using neighborhood groups and open houses that anyone can attend, but not everyone can attend. So I think it's one tool in our arsenal. The cool thing about a smartphone is that there's pretty good penetration across social lines and income brackets. So if we can reach those people, they do have the tool available. And I do think that we can certainly include a lot more people than we can include in like an open house. But I don't think we should rely on it as our sole source. And I think we should constantly be looking at ways to quantify the bias inherent in that data source.
Chris.
So I actually worry about a different equity risk in transportation than the data collection biases. I worry about the network density bias. It's very easy to roll out new transportation technologies where you have the densest network. So streetcar started in the central city. Bike share is going to start in the central city. Trying to get to the goal of 25% of trips by bike, the city's bike coordinator is looking to get most of those out of north and northeast Portland because it's the easiest place to get them. almost gives us an excuse not to do the hard work of looking at how do we make these transportation modes work for people in outer East Portland, for people in hilly Southwest Portland. I think we have to look past the easy parts of the network and work on the hard parts of the network.
Absolutely.
Get some applause for that. Michael.
So it's kind of one of the lines that I roll out whenever I get an opportunity to talk about some of the biases that exist when we think about transportation options. So it's kind of my Bernie Sanders 20-year, 25-year consistent line here. If you make investments in places where people have the highest proportionate cost for their transportation, when they have the lowest per capita car ownerships, and when they have some of the greatest barriers to the kind of network infrastructure and active transportation access, you're going to end up seeing some of the greatest economic, health, and social benefits of anywhere. And for us to not focus our time, attention, and resources in places where people have those challenges and those opportunities for growth in ridership and opportunity, it's just not smart. It's not one of these things where it's just like, oh, yeah, it should tug at your heartstrings. It should tug, at the pocketbook when we're thinking about the ways in which we need to approach the most effective and greatest return on investment opportunities in transportation. So want to make sure that that doesn't go unsaid. Thanks.
East Portland, because that's where the people are.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
What's a recent trip that one of you or each of you has taken personally where a self-driving car would have been useful? Michael.
Anytime you're on an interstate, I mean, give me a break. I-5, south, going anywhere, there's no reason why there shouldn't already be, one, the very real kind of proliferation of kind of Wi-Fi and stuff like that out there that would provide for the kind of network connection that you need in order to have all of the self-driving stuff. But you shouldn't have to. I mean, I go to my grandparents-in-law's down in Grants Pass. It's like 5 hours, right? That's like the worst amount of time to have to drive. And you use so little of your brain. Can we see a show of hands? How many people use so little of their brain when you have to drive on the interstate, right? It doesn't take anything except for the control of your right foot and a little bit of attention to what your hand is doing. It's like that's terrible, right? So there's no reason why those shouldn't be self-driven miles, kind of autonomous driven miles.
So William first.
Ooh, I think. Quick with the beg button. Every time that I'm on my bike and I get cut off or somebody doesn't see me or just treats me like a jerk, I can't wait to just ride circles around a self-driving car because it's like I just have this picture of like a cat in a cage and I'm a mouse on a bike. Just because it doesn't matter if the guy inside is a total jerk and he's driving a BMW. The BMW is going to, presumably at least, if they make self-driving cars safe, which is a whole separate issue. Assuming that BMW isn't saying, warning, pedestrian, and yelling at you to get out of the way before it hits you. Assuming that's not the case, it's going to be awesome.
Noelle, did you have one?
Oh. Yeah. I just think any time I'm walking, whether it's crossing the street or on the sidewalk, and speed is a major concern, if driverless cars work the way I would hope that they do, that there would be limits on the ability to speed, especially through neighborhoods or when there are, vulnerable roadway users present.
You would hope so, but then there's the cautionary tale of the speed governor in, what was it, 1920. So we've seen this before.
Chris.
So I'm going to use this as an opportunity to do my rant about autonomous vehicles, which is that how we do them is going to matter tremendously.
Yes.
So the nightmare scenario for autonomous vehicles is the autonomous chauffeur who drops you off at work and then circles around on the road system until you call it to take you somewhere else. The right way is the autonomous jitney that works like Uber Pool without a driver, that aggregates demand for multiple people, is shared ownership, and moves the most people most efficiently and reduces VMT. And there's a whole spectrum in between, but we have to pay attention to that, and I hope we'll get some policies about that in this TSP about what we Portland prefer.
Yeah.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yeah, go for it.
Given what we know about software
Question is, software sucks. Why will self-driving cars not suck? The software engineers want to answer.
Because drivers suck even more.
All right, and that's it. And William?
In my opinion, you shouldn't be worried about the software. I can understand as an engineer why you would. But you should be worried about the companies that are building it. Uber scares the crap out of me as a company, right? Like, I mean, they have to be the scariest company since the age of the robber barons. And the idea that because Portland and Portland is maybe even ahead of the game here, but the game's way behind. These cities have no idea how to respond to self-driving cars, and we have precious little language in our TSP to address it. And so Uber's going to be writing the playbook, and they're going to be hiring lobbyists to make sure that it gets passed into law. And just like the last time, the industry is going to roll it out. So we have to get ahead of that, because if we don't and Uber writes the playbook, man, I'm moving to Canada.
All right. We'll hold you to that. And it's half of our time on our questions is through, which means we're in good shape. So I'm going to keep moving. Sketch a plausible chain of events that takes us from tonight to self-driving buses. Go. Michael.
You asked for a sketch, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So the sketch is Daimler plus TriMet bus manufacturer, plus Otrek, plus money, plus Wi-Fi everywhere, plus fingers crossed.
That's brilliant. Done. All right. Get that man a startup. Chris.
Well, I'm actually a pessimist here, and three words, Amalgamated Transit Union.
The union,
Yeah, so, I mean, autonomous buses could do a lot to change the economics of transit in a very positive direction. I'm concerned that we'll get caught up in labor politics that will prevent that.
I agree with Chris. I think if there's a solution, it's probably going to start in the private sector, for better or worse. Well, we might see semi-fixed route, you know, semi-bus-like things that are self-driving or partially self-driving, and I hope that we can react and embrace the good parts of that, because I always say, like, it would be so much better to have a one-car train every 2 minutes than to have a five-car train every 10 minutes.
So you guys are all in favor of screwing the American worker, is that what I hear?
I mean, there's going to be downsides, and I'm... It's a difficult question.
Got to work on that one.
What's the sort of...
We don't have any telephone operators anymore, and we still have a much bigger economy than we did in 1942.
Lillian says we've done without telephone operators, and there are lots of workers employed right now.
But I do think it's a legitimate concern to look to private entities to provide transit.
Definitely.
I think, I don't know, this was maybe a question later on, but we already have seen with Car2Go cutting its service beyond 60th because it wasn't economically viable.
Right.
And if we don't have a transit system that serves all of our communities, and that's what people are relying on, that's really problematic and is worrisome to me.
Agree.
All right. What is the most promising technology you've seen for helping fight bike theft? Michael.
You know, I continue to roll out these really low-tech themes here, so I hope you guys are picking up on that. You know, U-locks work pretty well. A lot of times, and now they're getting into it here, the way in which people approach bike theft is either through cable cutting or a compression attack. So they use something like a car jack to get in there and break your lock from the inside out. So I would encourage you to upgrade it from a cable lock if you have a cable lock. And there are a number of different other technologies that are available to help prevent your bike from being stolen. So I don't have any other better answers than that.
Was that in your $50 million budget?
No.
Oh, it will be, though. Yeah, all right, great. Yeah. Chris.
Well, I've been watching some of the entrants in the sort of the GIS tracker space. I don't think any of them have hit the mass adoption point yet, but that would seem to be the most promising as sort of, you know, a low jack for your bike. But I'm not sure when we're going to hit the threshold.
Yeah, I can speak to that a little bit. It's a really challenging problem to build a low jack system for a bike that works well and is economically approachable for most people that ride a bike. So I'm not optimistic we'll see that maybe in 5 years.
I don't actually know what a LoJack is.
2 years. So basically just some sort of GPS-based tracking. Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be. Yeah.
Got
but,
it.
But a way to see where your bike is once it's stolen, basically. The other thing is that I'm not totally... it's kind of like the police body cam thing. It's like, well, it works, but will it work at scale? If there are as many bikes being stolen as there are today, and, you know, I don't believe vigilante justice is a good thing with this, is our current police staff going to be able to respond to a whole bunch of stolen bikes moving all over the map? Maybe, but I think it might not. I'm a much bigger believer in just, like, how do we get more eyes on the streets? How do we get business owners to, you know, step up a little bit and play a role in helping to prevent bike theft by just keeping eyes on the streets?
Interesting. Great. Here's a hard one. Is there a technology innovation that could revolutionize bike parking? Chris.
Well, as you know, this is an interest area of mine, and I've been working behind the scenes to get some zoning work done on bike parking for about 2 years now. And I'm happy to say we are just now forming a stakeholder advisory committee to actually start the project. So that's good. So I think, you know, number one issue for bike parking is to have more of it and better quality, right? So it's about having it more than the technology. But I would say in terms of technology, integrating it into trip planning would be important. Now, I don't know how many people actually do trip planning on their bicycle. I know some people do. Google will help you do it. TriMet will help you do it. But adding the ability to see where parking is near your destination would probably be a good add.
Cool. Noelle.
Yeah, I was thinking kind of along the same lines, but I don't know if there would be a way to connect it with an app like Yelp or a thing where businesses can kind of highlight the fact that they have bike parking, or it becomes a thing that you can search for, because I know when I am riding my bike to a restaurant, it's really helpful to know whether I'm actually going to be able to park it there.
Would you actually change your trip?
Sure.
All right.
If it was like same distance, this one has bike parking, this one doesn't.
If it had safe bike parking, especially.
Right.
Like, not just a staple, but something where I know my bike's not going to get jacked to eat dinner.
All right. Great. One of Lillian's dreams has been an integration of the transit appliance in her local bar with information about the distance and travel time to a good burrito. What is your dream integration of totally different apps? How could you imagine all of these technological services combining to solve your problems like lack of burritos and beer? Chris.
So I'm going to answer a slightly different question.
Good strategy.
My dream integration is not about the technology. It's about the services and the way we pay for them. So I would love to see in the Portland Central City that basically you pay for mobility once. So if you drive into downtown and park in a smart park, or if you take TriMet into downtown, that whatever the first instrument you pay for is, then gets you all the mobility you want in Central City. So if you paid for the parking, you get to use the streetcar, you get to use TriMet in Central City, you get to use bike share. Basically, you pay once, and then you use whatever mode is most convenient for your trips within the Central City, with the goal that you either arrive without a car, or if you must come with a car, you park it once and never move it again until you leave.
So it's going from Fairless Square to Fair Once Square.
Ooh, nice. All right, anybody else want to crack that one? All right. Yeah, Michael agrees. Is there anything to the idea of demand-responsive transit systems, like self-driving cars to go, or is the future all in fixed-route transit? I think Chris touched on this earlier. Are we building single... the one line down Hawthorne to rule them all, or are we building a bunch of lines down every street to rule your particular needs?
I just feel like we need to have reliable transit on the routes that we already have and in more places before I can even think about that.
I would follow that up. I think there's always a trade-off between sort of reliability and flexibility, and People think, oh, Uber is the most reliable way to get around, but it depends on how you think about it. If I make a trip, you know, plan for a doctor's appointment 3 months from now, and there happens to be surge pricing in effect when I need to go there, and I can't afford that, that's not reliable transit. It's reliable if you can afford it. And so one of the ways that we've dealt with this with public transit is we have fixed route, fixed schedule. So you know it's going to go to a certain place at a certain time, and it's not necessarily the most convenient, but it's reliable, and it will get you where you need to go. So I think that's always going to be a thing. And to the extent that we're claiming something's reliable when really we're just doing free market economics to let it be reliable for a certain percentage of the population, we shouldn't let that argument win.
Other takes? All right. This is a data planning question. How do we get good data for planning when more and more of the best transportation demand data, like that from Uber, for example, is in private systems where we can't get at it? Or where it costs something to get at it? Chris?
Well, I think, government is learning about this right now. I mean, the city has done a good job of requiring Uber and Lyft to turn over their data. We've found ourselves in a poor negotiating position with Airbnb to get the same kind of data. So I think, cities are going to have to learn to build in the data requirements as part of their regulatory schemes from the beginning. I think Williams actually got an interesting approach, which is to, gather the data privately, but then essentially make it open data. And I'm a big open data fan. I'm trying to get open data policies into the comp plan. So I think I'm going to pass the microphone to him and let him explain how that model is going to work.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm a big believer in open data. And one of the outcomes I hope we can have, or at least help contribute to, is cities sort of realizing that they can and should be demanding open data from any vendor that they work with or any service that they regulate. It should just be a basic, it should be table stakes. We're not there right now, and there's a lot of, it's difficult to even define what open data means. There's all kinds of gnarly issues around privacy, especially, which is one that we struggle with. But I think the bottom line is that this data should be thought of as a public asset, because we're all generating it after all, and we're giving it freely to these companies, and the companies are sitting on it and not sharing it. So I hope that we can help define that. And I think one of the things that you can do to start thinking about it is just think about what's the business model here and how well aligned does that place the company in question with the city and the citizens who want to use that data. Because one of the issues is when the data needs to be locked up in order to protect a business model, then you're really kind of out of alignment.
So you need the expectation that that's not an available business model, I suppose.
Well, or if that's the business model for a business that you're working with, that maybe they're not a good pilot.
Yeah. We got 5 minutes left, so we're going to move quick. Technology has made bike sharing possible, but apparently mostly so far for the rich, the white, and the educated. How long should we keep trying to broaden bike share access, and when, if ever, should we cut bait and give up and say bike sharing not for the public at large? Michael.
I think bike sharing is just one form of bicycle access and proliferation, and I think we need to fundamentally rethink some of the assumptions that we have that are tied to what we think of bike share, that it is composed of kind of node and network infrastructure that requires a high level of infrastructure investment in order to ensure the access and security of the bicycles that are on the ground. And instead, just let's look to a model that exists somewhere between all of the yellow bikes that we helped to pioneer here in Portland and some of the yellow bike programs that have existed all over the world. Many of those bicycles ended up in the river. I understand that. But there's something between that kind of anonymous, super awesome, hippy-dippy approach to proliferation of bicycle access and the kind of top-down, bureaucratic, infrastructure-heavy bike share system that we have. Thankfully, because Portland has been relatively late to the bike share party, we're able to see a kind of infrastructure that's really built into the bicycle itself and can allow for deployments that don't rely on proximity to other bike share access nodes in order for deployment. And I think that's really where we see innovation in bike share in the future.
All right. You think the spin lister model, is that related to what you're describing? This is where they have a floating, privately owned bike that, you know, is generating revenue as it goes around the city, and there's not a single thing. What do you think of that? That sounds like what you're describing. But
I'm not sure. I think that can work well too. We got to understand that when we're talking about bicycling, bicycle ownership and bicycle access are two different things. And ownership provides access, but it also ends up coming with a lot of other carrying costs and complications, like bicycle safety, storage, and maintenance. And so I think if we can just provide access to bicycles to everyday people in places where, again, they have the least per capita car ownership rates and the highest proportional transportation costs and the greatest potential benefits, we're going to end up seeing bicycle utilization that will kind of warrant that initial investment and the ongoing investment in maintenance, safety, and storage.
Yeah. William. Oh, I'm sorry. Noel, did I skip you?
No.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the models that we've seen applied so far are like not flexible enough and too centralized, which is kind of throws out two of the biggest advantages of biking. Also, they're really expensive, which throws out another advantage of biking. And so I would like to see some kind of looser kind of federated model where if a low-income housing project wants to install 20 bikes that can be used by those residents, and then another nearby project decides to do the same thing, that eventually they can share bikes and create a system in an ad hoc manner. But, you know, you don't have to have a central system that's connected to start out with. It can just be 20 bikes that are there for the people that need them the most.
This is the last question from me, and then I'll start taking some from the audience. Lily is collecting cards. Everybody should be writing things down and giving her cards with great ideas. But last question here, the most underrated form of low-car transportation. What is the maximum plausible percentage of the population that will be telecommuting by 2030, and how will they be doing it? Chris.
So I think this is definitely an opportunity area that we have not pursued. So, you know, I think right now it's 1 or 2%. It could easily be 10%, and I think it is going to take the leadership of some institutions and major employers to say that it can be a workable model for an employer. And, you know, I say this as somebody who telecommutes 9 days out of 10. I think there's an interesting social problem that has to be solved, that a lot of people will choose to go to work for the social connections involved. You know, I'm an introvert. I can work at home. I'm okay. I get my social connection by coming to public meetings, which is a little bit sad, but it works for me. But I think, you know, we have to solve that part of it. So whether that's, you know, the co-working facilities or what that's going to look like, but the, you know, the need to travel 7 to 20 miles to go to work is kind of silly.
Other answers? All right. Well, no, what percentage? Chris, you need what percentage?
I think we could get to 10.
All right, 10% by 2030. Great. We're starting with audience questions now. Thank you, guys.
Nope.
All right, great. Here's the first one. Name your favorite traffic signal in Portland and say why. Who in the audience could this question have possibly come? It didn't?
No. Sure.
Uh-huh. All right.
I got to give it up to the new pedestrian scramble.
All right.
Obviously.
This is the diagonal crossing in front of Powell's.
Yes. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Can you describe it more than
yeah,
just
that? Go ahead.
Well, it's where you can, pedestrians are allowed to cross diagonally. They're given a light so that all traffic on every side stops. So people can cross Kitty Corner. There's only one in Portland, and it just opened. You should check it out.
Anyone else?
Well, I'm still enjoying the new countdown timer at the Bicycle Scramble where the Esplanade meets the Rose Quarter. Dutch, actually, I think.
I got a snarky one. Alberta at MLK westbound or eastbound, that's just crying out for improvement. I don't know why yet. There's a number of crossings over there that need some improvement. So, again, that's snarky. I'm sorry.
What needs to change?
Well, you need to have a turn lane. You need to have a turn light, too. Reason why not. It's ridiculous. and it's not safe otherwise. It's not even, particularly great. So, yeah.
Awesome. All right.
As the person collecting questions, these are getting wonkier and wonkier as I pick them up. They've moved from, what's your favorite app to, how do we get the TSP to include this particular thing? So I might not take the more wonky ones.
Is freight an ally or a foe? Freight.
I'll take
it. William wants to.
I want it.
So I've long thought that, as a bicyclist, that we could be getting along better with freight because so my uncle's actually a truck driver. Well, my uncle Lal, really, but I think of him as an uncle. And he basically was telling me about how terrifying it is to drive in a city. It sounds a lot like biking because you're constantly worried that cars around you are going to do stupid stuff and you can't see them. And he's not going to die, but he could lose his job really easily. So that sounds a lot like the way I feel. And theoretically, at least, they should be able to follow predictable routes and patterns. Theoretically, they shouldn't be in a giant rush to get home and see their kids. So there's some good things there. That could put us in better alignment and just the general notion that roads shouldn't be for private vehicles. That's also a major form of alignment. So I'd like to see more there where we sort of bridge that gap and create kind of some uncanny partnership.
So my view is that freight is our greatest ally who has not yet had their conversion experience. The common enemy of active transportation and freight is the single occupancy vehicle. But so far, freight has chosen to align themselves with capacity expansion policies rather than with policies that limit the SOV. Someday they're going to get there. I'll tell my story from the Netherlands. I cut my teeth in transportation as the transportation chair for a neighborhood association. And we did the Northwest Bikeways plan, and all the bikeways had to stop as soon as they hit the Northwest Industrial Neighborhood. They wanted no part of bikeways. In 2005, I had a chance to go to the Netherlands, met with some freight interests near the airport there, and said, hey, do you have bikeways in your freight districts? And they said, of course, how else would our employees get to work? So we need that moment to happen in Portland. It hasn't happened yet. It has to happen at some point.
All right. Got some amens. Is automated speed enforcement good or bad for equity?
I guess.
Go ahead. I don't think I understand the question, to be honest. And this might be me being overly black and white about it, but I just think, man, if you can't afford a speeding ticket and you know that there's an automated camera there, then you don't speed, right? I mean, and it's a tough one because I always try to think about both sides of the equation here, but speed kills, and it's really hard to feel like we should, try to temper our response on this one.
Great. Noelle.
So I think that there are two sides of this. One of the pros to it is kind of removing some subjectivity to pulling people over. But on the other side of the coin is that all of our most dangerous roads are in low-income neighborhoods and communities of color. So these cameras are more likely to pull those people over or to give them tickets, regardless of whether they can pay it or not. It's just the fact that they're in the neighborhoods where people can't afford it.
So you're saying that
the dangerous roads are in low-income communities, communities of color, because, and therefore people are going to be prompted to speed because of the way the roads are built, or are you saying that it's...
Yeah. I mean, the way the roads are built, the reason why they're the most dangerous roads is because they're built to encourage speeding.
Right.
So regardless of whether you lower the speed limit, it's just more likely to happen, and that's just, you know, you see the underinvestment in these communities, and then we're kind of throwing on cameras on top of that. I still think that they serve a valuable purpose, but that's a definite equity concern that has to be taken into
account.
Never
thought of that. That's a great point.
I think there's a fix that some countries have adopted, which is that the fine should be proportional to your income.
Right. Mm. Sweden, right?
All right. Freaking Scandinavians win again. All right. Great question. This is a question, sort of question about the questioning. There's a perilous but potentially beneficial intersection of privilege when we talk about bikes and tech, because both of those things are exclusionary by default as they exist today. So how do we help ensure that solutions expand and broaden access and availability rather than cater to people who would probably be okay on their own, like me?
So we all give to the community cycling center through the Give Guide.
All right.
Everyone give to Oregon Walks because everyone is a pedestrian through the Give Guide.
That's true.
And furthermore, I think it's in multimodal coalition and collaboration and reaching out to partners in freight that we're going to be able to find solutions that will meet the needs of absolutely everyone should they decide to engage.
Great. Here, here. Here's a fun one. Who is the best presidential candidate for transportation from a technology perspective?
Bernie. I mean, vote Bernie. For the Bern. He's going to be able to spend the money to make the things happen within the United States that have been long overdue. And a lot of what we see when it comes to transportation has to do with a predominant narrative related to scarcity, right? We don't have enough money for that. We don't have enough money for that. We don't have the funding for that. And that's just not true. We're just providing a lot of big tax loopholes. We just saw $680 million worth of tax benefits for big corporations pass at the national level. We've seen a big mess of $1 trillion omnibus package at the national level. So I don't want to get too much into it, and I know we're running out of time, but happy to chat with anyone that's interested in that question afterwards.
We got a few minutes, but we're doing all right? All right, great. So I'm going to finish with one more question, then we'll move to predictions for next year. That'll be our final lightning round. So here's the last question from the audience. The future of paratransit, delivery drones or self-driving cars? I'm not sure what paratransit is referred to here, but
paratransit means for digital.
Can somebody clarify this? No, I know what paratransit is, but what's the meaning of this question?
So the issue is...
Hi, Steph.
Steph. Yeah, all right.
We're on a podcast. Thank you. Sorry. So ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, requires paratransit, which is what? Where am I going?
Video.
Thank you. the issue is that paratransit is required in that anyone who is over a certain age or has a disability has to have reasonable accommodation. So one of the main issues is it is an unfunded mandate. A lot of people, when we're talking about the future of transportation and some profound limitations related to paratransit, a ride connection, and their limited access, people talk about technological solutions. And I've heard both. Well, hey, we're going to have drones that can deliver anything that anyone needs. Or we will have self-driving cars, so we don't need ride connection anymore. So what is the future? Because aging in place is a huge concern. We have a growing aging population, and with aging comes a greater probability of disability. What is a technological solution if you had to choose between delivery drones related to Amazon, hi Chris, and self-driving cars? Which is it?
Those are our only options.
So, for this,
the purpose of this, yes.
Right. So my understanding is that the FAA is limiting drones to 55 pounds, which Amazon thinks means 50 pounds of drone and 5 pounds of delivery. So, you know, could you do Meals on Wheels with drones? Probably.
Six drones.
Personally, I think Ride Connection is going to be around for a long, long time. That would be my prediction.
Until you can deliver cat food on drones.
What was the other option?
It was self-driving cars. Or drones. Or it's status quo, I guess. That's the Chris is voting for status quo.
The most expensive part of Ride Connection right now is...
driver.
Is the driver. So, theoretically, the thing that would make Ride Connection be cheaper to operate, because it's... how much is it right now?
Are you talking about Lyft?
Yeah, Lyft. Yeah. So Lyft right now is how much?
It's like $25 a ride or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you are not paying the salary of a driver and you have a robot doing it instead, suddenly it becomes a lot cheaper. So.
Right. There's a lot of savings.
But some of those passengers need assistance.
That is certainly true.
Robots are very good at assisting humans.
All right. All right, great. So Lily's prediction is that robots are going to get much better at assisting humans, I think. What are the rest of our predictions for 2016? Chris?
Portland will adopt a TSP.
It needs to be technology.
All right, well, I'll go out on a limb and say, and I'll manage to get some autonomous vehicle policies inside of that TSP.
All right.
Boy, next year?
Next year. By 2017.
That's a tricky one. I want to go. I'm going to cheat, too. Yeah, we'll figure out how to fund all this cool stuff, technology and otherwise.
Yeah. All right.
I wanted to use this answer for another question, so I'm going to use it. I want there to be an app that detects when leaves are blocking your drain so that you can preemptively clean it, and then the sidewalks aren't flooded.
All right.
Next year.
Yeah, next year. That's going to happen.
Yeah, sticking with a consistent, relatively simple theme, no reason why there shouldn't be free available Wi-Fi on all public transit and at all public transit stations. There's just no reason why that shouldn't be the case.
All right. Well, then it's going to happen. Yeah. All right. Sweet. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. That is our show. And you can subscribe to the show at bikeportland.org/podcast and send us any comments you have at podcast@bikeportland.org.
Thank you so much to Simple for hosting us for this month's podcast and to all of our awesome guests. And thanks Lagunitas Brewing, Hopworks, Urban Brewery, and Alberta Street Co-op for keeping our guests fueled tonight. You can learn more about Simple, an innovative new bank, at simple.com.
And you can follow Bike Portland on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Michael Anderson, Bike Portland's news editor.
Thank you all of our guests today, Noel, Michael, William, and Chris. And I'm Lillian Kerbake, your podcast producer. You can spread the word about the show by searching for Bike Portland on iTunes and leaving a review.
And we will all do the exit together. Are you ready? You have a slip of paper here.
Yes.
All right.
Thanks for listening.
On your cue.
And until next time,
remember to exit through the back.
Pass on the left.
And don't forget to thank your bus driver.
Woo!